You are listening to Gangland Wire, hosted by former Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit Detective Gary Jenkins.
Well, welcome all you wiretappers out there. I'm here in the studio of the Gangland Wire. I appreciate all your support out there. Don't forget to hit me up on the Venmo app. Buy me a cup of coffee or a shot and a beer at Gangland is the code on that. We have a caller today. We have a telephone interview with a former copper like myself, Joe Broadmeadow from back east, who's done a lot of work on the New England mob. And he has a particularly interesting book about Jerry Tillinghast, who was closely connected with, I think it was a Gerard Wimette crew in New England and part of the Raymond Patriarch, I think they call him the office. Welcome, Joe. Why don't you tell a little bit of our listeners a little bit about your background, how you came to be working with these guys in your career?
Well, thank you, Gary. Well, I'm a retired captain from East Providence, Rhode Island. Worked a number of different, when I was a young detective growing up on the job, I worked in a number of different task forces, organized crime, drug enforcement task force with the FBI and various local and state police. We did a lot of cases together. Rhode Island being the smallest state in the country, you know, everybody is working on the same cases. Organized crime was pervasive back in the 60s, 70s before my time. And even up into the 80s and 90s. So we had quite a bit of contact with those guys. To make a long story short, what happened was after I retired, I began my writing career. I always had written even when I was on the job, but I'd written a number of books, and I was contacted by an attorney by the name of Paul DeMeo, who's one of the more well-respected criminal defense lawyers out here in Rhode Island. He asked me if I'd be interested in doing a project with this guy by the name of Jerry Tillinghast, who I, of course, knew the name. Jerry was a well-known mob enforcer. He had just recently been released after serving 33 years in prison for a murder conviction. And coincidentally, my father had been with the state police, and my father had arrested Jerry on a number of occasions. So I knew the name from the past. And I met with Jerry, and we had a little discussion about how we would go about writing his story. One of the things that I said was, we're going to write the book. We're going to write it. Anything that I can't verify is not going to go in the book. And the two of us sat down, and he told me his story, and that's how the book came about. And the book essentially tells the story of how Jerry, if you put Jerry Tillinghast's name in a Google search or any kind of an internet search engine, it'll pop up and it'll say Jerry Tillinghast, notorious bossa. And I was always curious how a guy like a Tillinghast, who's not Italian, had no real association with organized crime, ended up where he did. And it's sort of a backstory to Jerry. Jerry was a Marine. He had volunteered to join the Marine Corps, volunteered to go to Vietnam, and got involved in an incident over there where he was charged with two other Marines with a rape of a South Vietnamese woman, even though he had not actually committed the rape. He was charged with aiding and abetting. I mean, long story short, he was convicted, essentially received a more severe sentence than the two Marines who actually committed the rape, was given a dishonorable discharge later, upgraded to a bad conduct discharge, and served a year in prison. He actually served more time in prison than the two Marines who committed the rape. And the reason that happened was that Jerry refused to give them a statement. The Marines that were involved gave statements. Jerry wouldn't do that, and that was just because of his background. Growing up in South Providence, Rhode Island, you just were not a rat. You didn't talk to anybody regardless of the circumstances. So Vietnam, 19 years old, chip on his shoulder, very angry about what happened, and I ended up getting around with the wise guys. I actually managed to contact, which really put it over the top for me, Judge Advocate General Marine, back then was a First Lieutenant of the Marine Corps, who represented Jerry back in Da Nang in 1966 at the court-martial. His name is Mike Hanlon. He is now a retired presiding justice of the California Court of Appeals. He was a very long and distinguished legal career. And when I contacted him, I didn't tell him what it was about. I just asked to speak with him. And when I mentioned Jerry's name, he knew the case intimately. He knew all the players. He knew all the witnesses. And this was from a case from 50 years ago. And essentially what he told me was that it always, in his legal career, he distinctly remembered three cases where he thought people were, you know, had suffered a miscarriage of justice, and one of them was Jerry Tillinghast. So in a nutshell, Jerry came home. He's 19 years old. He's angry. He's got a felony conviction. Can't get a job. What does the Marine Corps teach you how to do? Marine Corps teaches you how to, you know, kill people, how to handle weapons. Jerry was a tough kid. He had been a boxer. And he ended up hanging at a bar by a name called the Bronx Tap that was controlled by a guy named Gerard Ouimet, who was, for all intents and purposes, even though he was not Italian, was the second in command in the patriarchal organization in Rhode Island. And Jerry, he's a tough kid. He brought him along.
Sorry, I was reading your book. It was about they're called the Bronx Tap. That's kind of an interesting name, the Bronx Tap. Do you remember anything about that joint? Was it just like a little neighborhood joint that anybody could go into?
A little pub. It was run, you know, Gerard officially was not the owner. The two brothers that ran it, but Gerard muscled his way in. Gerard had a tight connection to New York. He was a very close associate of John Gotti. There was a very tight, very interesting, very tight connection to those guys.
Okay.
So I don't know if that had anything to do with the name of it, but, you know, it was a neighborhood bar, working men's bar, you know, shot in the beer kind of place, not the kind of place you walk in and order a martini, you know, shot of Fleshman's in a Gary.
I know the joint intimately.
Yeah, those kind of places. So,
yeah.
And you know, Jerry started to build a reputation. He actually was charged with 6 different murders over the course of his career. And the first 5 cases were either dismissed for lack of evidence or dismissed on other grounds. And then the 6th one was a rather interesting story because the victim in that case was a guy by the name of George Basmasian, who was another bad, very tough enforcer for the mob. And George Basmasian was being followed by the state police and the FBI in this particular night. FBI and the state police followed him in a car. Jerry was driving, Basmasian was driving, Jerry was in the front seat. And then they lost the car. The cops following him lost the car. So they went looking for him. Ultimately, end up finding Jerry driving. Third person in the front and in the back seat in a stolen car coming out of the back of a bowling alley. And they followed him down towards the airport here in Rhode Island, and they lost him for a moment on the highway. And when they regained the car, there were only 2 people in the car now and 2 people in the front seat. So they were under the impression that Basmasian had somehow managed to get out of the car and, you know, was looking to case someplace that they were going to do some kind of a job. So they backed off on him a little bit. Waited a little while and then decided that they should move in and find out what they were doing. So the car had pulled down this back of a industrial area, and they pulled down, located the car, and they're in the back seat, dying and certainly shortly to be dead, was George Basmasian with 9 bullet holes in him.
Wow.
So they went out and located Jerry at a bar in Providence and placed him under arrest for murder. And they also arrested his brother, Harold. And the testimony was that Harold was the second person in the car when Basmasian was killed. There was a lot of conflicting testimony about the information that Harold was in the car. And honestly, if you read the book, you'll see that based on my review of the court transcripts and the forensic evidence and the circumstances under which the Harold was identified, it was clear that Harold was not in that car.
Mm-hmm.
But Jerry had refused to give a statement. That was just the way he was. So they both were convicted. Harold did 15 years. Jerry still wouldn't say anything. And ultimately, Harold died. And then about a year before I started working on the book with Jerry, a guy by the name of Skippy Burns, who was one of another associate of Gerard Ouimet, he also died, so Jerry felt that now he could talk about what happened, and he told me the story that it was actually Skippy Burns who was in the car, and he's the one who actually shot George.
Mm.
So, you know, that code of silence that those guys adhered to, Jerry's sort of an old-school guy, and he his brother did 15 years in prison for a murder he didn't commit, and Jerry still didn't think you should talk about it. So that's why that, you know, there's always more. You know, a lot of times organized crime guys tend to be one dimensional. Everybody thinks of them as just bad guys. They're just bad guys. You know, they're murderers, or they're bookies, or they're loan sharks, or whatever, extortionists. But a lot of times with some of these guys, not so much with the made members or the guys who are, you know, part of a family thing. But a lot of these associates, there's always a story behind them. And I think Jerry's is a really interesting story.
Yeah, it is. You know that, and in your book, I noticed you've got kind of the transcript of the police surveillance that night, which I found most interesting. I've been on a couple of deals like that myself. We're watching a guy, a local mob guy, he's playing darts with this dude, and you know, we're watching him and kind of back off and they leave. All of a sudden, they're gone, and we realize they're gone. We lose them for like 15. We find the mob guy by himself driving down the road 15, 20 minutes later. And the next morning, the guy had been playing darts with, he find him dead in his car in the immediate vicinity. It's just crazy. I mean, it's so hard to catch somebody in the act. They're so cagey and canny. And
the other thing that's really frustrating a lot with, you know, you watch these, you know, these TV shows, movies, they always make following people so easy.
Yeah.
Following people is friggin' impossible.
It is.
You know, not if you don't want anybody to know. I mean, I always get a kick out of this. There's one show, they'll be sitting in a black or a dark blue Crown Victoria with black wall tires at the end of the intersection, you know, with a camera hanging out the window, taking pictures of these guys. And they're not, you know, it just doesn't happen that way, you know.
But you know, today, Joe, they just take a GPS locator and slap it up underneath.
I'm a big fan of technology. And, you know, and sitting in the office drinking coffee, watching them that way is much easier. But, you know, but it's just... You know, that's why, you know, again, when I first started to work on Jerry's book, quite honestly, I had a little bit of reluctance to do it because, you know, Jerry's a bad guy. I mean, he'd be the first one.
I know. I've got the same kind of dualistic thing with some guys I work with. Like, I know what they've done. I know what they're capable of. But when you get to know them,
you got to tell their story.
Yeah,
you got to tell the story, and that's what I think it's. It doesn't. And Jerry, that's why we called the book Choices, because you know Jerry, he can be charming. He's very funny. You have to remind yourself that he was a convicted murderer, but he'll tell you. He says, you know, nobody put a gun in my head and made me do the things I did. He said, you know, he was pissed when we came back from Vietnam. Which gives a, you know, sort of a reason why he may have made bad choices back then. But he said, but they were my choices.
Yeah.
And he said, and he'll say, that's why we said it, it's choices. You know, you own them. When you make those choices, you know, you own the response. You know, you own the responsibility for it.
And he did that.
He doesn't make the life,
glamorous
or, you know, he tells it like it is. It was a treacherous, evil. Nasty, vicious world that those guys operate in.
It is.
Let's talk a little about one that subject that's near and dear to my heart because I've been on a few of these, the big heist kind of deals. We caught some guys robbing a bank because the Bureau was already all over them with a wiretap, and we knew they were going to burglarize this bank, and we caught them inside. It's really hard to do, as you know. The bonded vault case now, wouldn't that have been something been set up on that? That was a heck of a deal there.
Yeah, the bonded vault was the largest heist in Rhode Island, one of the largest heists in the country, because essentially, bonded vault was a private, unofficial safe deposit box location bank, so to speak, that only the wise guys or those that they were, you know, invited would keep all their stolen goods, stolen material, guns, whatever. And what happened was Raymond Patriarca, who the head of the organization, he went to prison for 5 years. And when he came out, he didn't think that the guys that were out on the street had properly taken care of himself, him or his family, didn't get enough money from him. So he knew about the bank. Some people think he actually ran it, but so through Gerard Ouimet, he arranged to hit this place, and they took. Back then, the original estimates were was between $3 and $5 million worth, but the reality was more on the lines in 1976 dollars. Of $30 to $50 million.
Wow.
And Jerry, this is the, all these guys are connected. Two of the guys who were involved in the bonded vault were Jerry Tellinghast and Skippy Burns, who ultimately would, you know. And Jerry was found not guilty. Jerry had an alibi witness who testified, and they couldn't break the alibi witness, so Jerry was found not guilty. Three guys were convicted, three guys were found not guilty. They never recovered the overwhelming majority of the money. What happened was one of the guys by the name of Dusalt took off to Las Vegas, went through all his money, started robbing banks out there, ultimately got caught. And they told him that they actually sent Gerard Ouimet, sent a few guys out to Las Vegas to kill Dusalt. A guy by the name of Chucky Flynn was also one of the bonded vault robbers. And Dusalt and Flynn had a long relationship. So Dusalt and Flynn came to an agreement that, you know, Dusalt would never testify, so Flynn didn't kill him. Ultimately, Dusalt got caught. He flipped. And the reason he flipped is because the cops told him that they killed Chucky Flynn. They said, hey, killed your friend. Of course, he wasn't dead, but Dusalt didn't know that.
It was a good interrogation technique, you'll have to admit.
Yeah, it works every time.
Yeah,
it does. So he gave up, so he gave him a statement, and ultimately he testified at trial. And when he went, but, you know, the money inside that place, the gold and coins and all the rest, there are pictures from inside that place where literally they are knee-deep, you know, standing knee-deep in gold and jewelry.
In gold and money and jewelry.
And money. They took roughly $800,000 in cash. They didn't even take the fives because it wasn't worth it.
Yeah.
It wasn't worth it. So ultimately it's a very interesting case. And again, it shows all the interconnectedness. All these guys are bad guys. You know, the cops didn't even have a complaint from anybody about, other than the robbery. They didn't have a complaint about what was stolen, because all these, how are you going to, well, look, they stole that money that I stole.
You know? It was
a perfect crime. You know, you can't very well, you know, make a complaint about somebody stealing the money that you stole from somebody else.
If you got no victim, it's like a shoplifter, a booster. If they steal something from the store and walk out and get across the street and nobody, you know, reports it or says anything, no crime happened. I've told that to people, and they look at me like I got two heads, but no crime happened. That is how it works. Interesting. I tell you what, those big heists like that.
It's an interesting story. Jerry's is an interesting story. And there's a lot of other kind of, you know, and all the stuff that Jerry was involved with. I always joke with him about this. So all the things that Jerry was involved with, all the incidents, you know, how many of the various things that you might imagine he was involved with. Jerry was only shot one time. He was shot in the knee by his wife because he was taking her out to dinner.
Oh, boy. Oh, I did read that in your book. It was like more like an accidental shooting, wasn't it?
No, she wanted to kill him. She didn't want to kill him. He just wasn't going to take her out to dinner, so she wasn't going to let him go. So she shot him in the knee.
I got hit in the knee with a motorcycle helmet one time when I came in real late, but...
That's the only time you get hurt.
Anyway, he was the man's man, it sounds like, and
he's an interesting character, like I said,
kind of guy you'd rob a bank with.
Yeah, he's a very personable guy. So he's
interesting,
and it's a great, you know, granted I'm a little prejudiced because I wrote the book, but the book is a very interesting story. It's not your typical mob story.
It is. You draw out Jerry Tellinghast's character and a lot more about him, which to me makes it more interesting. And then the details and like having that surveillance log in there, and I found it fascinating. And it's just like such an inside look. I love those that intermediate level of mob people, the crews that worked for the mob guys, like Goodfellas. That was always my favorite mob movie and book, because it told the inside story of those different personalities and people that really went out where the rubber meets the road and did the work and did the capers and everything. I mean, this thing was like the Lufthansa heist, where one guy goes out and starts spending money like crazy and starts drawing attention, so they're going to have to go kill him off.
Yeah, right.
God, it is a great book. Choices, folks. It'll be on on Amazon. I'll have a link to this on my I have a blog page that I put the podcast up on, and then it goes to the podcast apps too. But I'll put some pictures in there, and then I'll have a link to all of your books. You've written several, Joe. It's you've been pretty prolific in your retirement here.
Yeah, no, I've become like the author to the mob, because all these guys, you know, these white guys coming out of the woodwork. I don't want to have that story told.
Yeah, exactly.
I keep trying to tell them it's going to be a unique here. Story.
Yeah, I'm getting a little bit of the same thing here. I even had a guy recently got hold of me through a mutual friend he had met. He'd kind of got reformed and started going to a church, and then he meets a guy who knows me, who's a retired a university policeman, but he knew me. And so he's talking, and this my friend says, "Oh, you need to get a hold of this guy. He does all kinds of stuff, and like what you're talking about." So the guy called me, and he tells me his name. It's like, oh my God, I was a sergeant in charge of the case that brought him down. And so we've met for coffee several times, and we're trying to get together. He's, you know, what part of the problem is, and you may run into this, Providence is not that big a city.
No.
Kansas City's not that big a city, and so people have extended family, they just have to be careful about, you know, they don't want their relatives to be painted with the brush of being an informant. That's one reason nobody here ever went in the witness protection program, because of their extended family. They're the ones that are going to be damaged in a way socially, because they all go to each other's weddings and funerals and are married into each other's families or extended families and godfathers and all that kind of stuff. So we're negotiating now on how getting him on the podcast. He's still a little nervous, but he's a fun guy. He's the funniest guy I've ever met.
Yeah. They are. They, you know, Jerry can be like that. He's very, very humorous.
Yeah, I've seen the interview on the internet. He's funny. He's an interesting guy. He's just the kind of guy that is easy to work with. But you got to remember, don't you, Joe?
You got to
keep in the back of your mind, this is what he's capable of.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Interesting.
And you never know, somebody, some other family member that might think that. Oh, actually, I'll tell you a funny story. We were at a book signing. Jerry and I were at a book signing. So Jerry was sitting there, and a woman comes walking up to me. She didn't recognize Jerry, but Jerry's picture is on the front of the book. So she looks at me. She says, "Did you write this book?" I said, "Yeah, I did." So she points at him. She says, points at the book, and she says, "I would never buy that because he killed my cousin."
Oh God.
Yeah. So Jerry is sitting there. Jerry goes, "Who's your cousin?" So she tells him the cousin's name. He says, "I didn't kill your cousin." He says, "George Basmasian killed your cousin."
There you go.
And the lady ended up buying the book anyway. So
small world. We got the same thing here in Kansas City. It's a small world.
Exactly what it is.
Interesting.
Okay. All right, Joe, this has been great. This is a really interesting story. We're about out of time here. Can you come back and talk to us about Bobby Wallison and your other book, Unmade? He's a pretty interesting guy. He's a kind of another Jerry Tilly nest, it sounds to me like.
Kind of. Yeah, I'd be happy to come back. That'd be
great. Well, folks, if you have a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900. Or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. And don't forget to, you can download and rent my movie, Gangland Wire, at Amazon for only $1.99. I have the Kansas City Mob Tour app that's available in the Apple App Store. I have my book, Leaving Vegas, How FBI Wiretaps Ended Mob Domination of Las Vegas Casinos. And come back and listen to the podcast more often. Give us a review if you would. I appreciate it. You can make a donation on my website page. If you give me $25, I'll send you a copy of the DVD that has all the special features on it. All right, Joe, thanks a lot for being here, and I look forward to talking to you next week.
Good night. Thank you, Jerry.
Music provided by our good friend and super fan from Portland, Oregon, Casey McBride. Thanks, Casey.